Okay. My name is Liesl Norby, and I am 17 years old. Today is the 16th of December, 2022, and I'm speaking with Scott Norby, who is my grandpa, and I'm recording this interview in Riverton, Utah. All right. So, the first question is, who were your parents, and can you tell me about them?
My parents were Clinton and Margaret Norby. My dad was born in Idaho Falls. My mother was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. They met before my father was shipped out for World War II and wrote while he was overseas in Europe. He was in a bomber group. My dad was the youngest of two boys. His mother wanted more children, but she wasn't able to have them. My mother was the third born of eight children. And she grew up, her father worked for the post office, so he had a job during the Depression. And they also raised chickens, so they always had chickens and eggs. My father, on the other hand, his father struggled during the Depression. And so they didn't have a lot. He learned to, whatever was on the table that night, that's what you ate, because there was nothing else in the house. Whereas my mother always had food. My dad, his family, they liked liver and onions because that was cheap and you could buy a lot of that. My dad didn't. So he had lots of mayonnaise sandwiches, just bread and mayonnaise spread on them. He liked that, and that's what he had, because he wasn't going to eat liver and onions. One time he found a dime and brought it home and was so excited, and his mother told him, take it back to the store and see if anyone claims it. And so he took it back to the store and waited a few days, went back, and he said, well, apparently no one has claimed it. No one knows they lost it. The dime was a lot of money then. And my dad was disappointed because he wanted to go buy candy. He could buy a lot of candy for a dime. But his mother said, well, go get the dime and buy a loaf of bread and the biggest piece of bologna you could have. And my dad says, that's what they had to eat that night for dinner. That's all they had. When my dad and mom were courting, they had a situation where he went out there for dinner, and because he was the guest, they gave him a choice of pies. And my grandma Lydia was a great cook, and so she made lots of pies for every dinner or every meal on Sunday. And so he just took one, you know, the decision. And then he found out afterwards that he could have had as many slices as he wanted. He said, oh, I should have taken some more. So that gives you a little bit about their upbringing. My dad in the World War II, he was on a B-17. He was a flight engineer and the top turret gunner. On their first mission, they bombed a target in France. Second mission, they were going to bomb the marshaling yards or the train stations in Munich. They were hit and began losing altitude. They had injured on board. And they were ordered to try to, if they had enough altitude, to get into Switzerland where they could be protected and have some help for those who were wounded. They were able to do that. And the last couple of months in the war, my dad was interned in Switzerland and then came back to the States. They married after my dad got back in 1946. And I came along in 50, I was the oldest. And then my brothers and sisters came later. So that gives you just a very, very brief outlook on them. They've always been members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, had strong testimonies of it. And I grew up being raised in the gospel, for which I'm very grateful for. So that's the end of that question.
All right. The next question is, do you know the story of how our family first came to this country?
Comes from two different main countries. One is the Norby name, which is out of Norway. Originally, it was spelled N-O-R-D-B-Y. And I've since learned that the D in Norwegian, when you have it like that, it's silent, so it would be Norby. My grandfather came here, and everyone was spelling it wrong and saying it wrong, and so he just said, well, I'll just drop the D and make it Norby. And so that's what he did. Back then, you didn't have to go through court or anything. That's what he did, and that's how it stuck. So anyway, my great-grandfather, who was Olaf Hansen, joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Norway, and at that time, the instructions from the prophet were to come to Utah. And so they came to Utah. He was disowned by his father because he joined the church. He had another brother that joined the church, and he settled in the Provo area. But apparently they didn't know a whole lot about each other. It was a major undertaking then to be able to see each other because you didn't have cars initially. So either by wagon or horse. As he came over here, he met another young lady from Norway who had joined the church. And they got married. And so that was that particular family. My mother's side, they were from England, suburb of London, basically. And they joined the church over there. And similar, they came over by ship and then came to the Salt Lake Valley and settled that area. So that was the major families, how they got here, and it was because of the church.
All right. Next question is, how did you and Grandma meet?
After graduating from the University of Utah, I went to work with Kennecott, and they sent me down to Arizona where they had an opening. I went down there. I hadn't met my wife because I didn't have time to date when I was going to school very much. I was studying, working, or sleeping. But anyway, so I got down to Kearney, Arizona, a small little mining town. There were no girls my age. I thought, oh, wonderful. Tried going down to Tucson. I thought, that'll never work. That was an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on traffic down there. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to have to find someone here and have some help on that. Paula was down in Mesa at that time going to beauty school. And so her brother lived in Arizona in a small little town called Kelvin, I think is what it was named. And he and his brother worked for Kennecott. They were truck drivers and I was their supervisor. So that's how I knew them and they knew me. And then I was in the Elders Quorum Presidency at that time. And so Brent, Paula's oldest brother, told Paula, hey, there's a boy who wants you to meet up here. Why don't you come live with us? And things worked out such she decided she would. And they introduced me one night at a genealogical class. And when the class was over, I went home. That's what you do. But they purposely brought Paula there to meet me, and I took off. So they had me meet her at church. I guess the first time I remember meeting her was at Pioneer Days or something. Kearney had that. And they had various little booze and some kiddie carnival rides, things like that. It made it fun for the community. Met her there, and I didn't remember it. And then you move ahead. That was in, I think, May. And then Brent and Helen. Helen was Brent's wife's name. They went back to visit his parents. And so Paula was alone, and she came to church by herself. And I met her, and I had already decided to ask her for strawberry shortcake, but I didn't know how to make strawberry shortcake. So I called my mother, bought all the ingredients. Said, okay, this is what you'll need. And So I finally got up enough courage to ask her. And I went out and picked her up, came back. I didn't have a TV then. I was just a poor student, basically. And so she said, well, I've got a TV out there. So we went out there, and I said, well, I've got to whip up the whipped cream, and I've never done that before, but my mom told me how to do it. And Paula said, oh, I know how to do it. And she had it all done and nothing flat. I bought strawberries. She cut them all up, put some sugar with them, made them nice and sweet. And we had strawberry shortcake. There was something different I felt about her on the first date. And I remember that night praying about it. And I said, Father, is this the one? And I had a very good feeling about it, a warm feeling. I thought, well, I can't ask her to marry me after one date. And so I dated her for a while, and we did various things. It was challenging because she had Sunday, Monday off, and I had Saturday, Sunday. And so she was down in Mesa, Arizona, going to beauty school, and wouldn't get home till late. But we made it work, had some dates, and finally asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And the rest is history. Six boys later and 26 grandkids later.
All right. The next question is, what was my dad like growing up?
Okay, Liesl's dad is Jeffrey. We call him Jeff. He was born being neat and clean. When you'd feed him and he'd get just a little bit of food on the corner of his mouth, he would, and you had to clean it off, and then he would eat again. But he wouldn't eat if he had a dirty mouth. As he got older, he always kept his room clean. His next youngest brother was Eric. And Eric was our biggest slob of our six boys. He didn't care about a bit. If it was messy, that's okay. Didn't bother him, but it bothered Jeff. And so that was always a challenge for him. But good student. Kept the commandments. Tried to do what was best. He had good friends. Served a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was in Japan. And that worked out good for him because they're so clean and fastidious that just fit right in with his nature. And he enjoyed that, having things orderly in their place. Came back, and he's still that way. Married, he's got four kids, and he's still neat, a neat freak, if you want to call it that. But we clashed at times. He was my firstborn. I had to learn on him a bit, but things worked out. Grateful for his example for his younger brothers. We had six children, so Jeff has five younger brothers. Setting the example for them as to what to do and things like that. I remember each of my boys, when we're talking about Jeff, asked me, well, what am I going to do, Dad, if I get after I get back from a mission? I said, get a college education. Whatever you pick is fine. If you don't want to get that, that's fine, but you'll make less money. As long as it's honorable work, you don't have a problem with that. But if you want to make more, you're going to have to put forth the work and effort to get that college degree. So he started out, he wanted to go into mining like I had been in. And I said, no, don't go into mining. There are challenges. It's all going overseas, a lot of it. And so he tried chemistry, came back from his mission and got into it. He says, Dad, I don't like this. I said, well, change your major. Change my major? I've already spent a year and a half on this. I said, it's better to find out now than to go into something that you don't like. So he changed his major to accounting. And loved it, absolutely loved it. And so that's taken him all over the world. His various jobs, he lives in Reno now, working for a company that makes safety showers and safety eye washes that are used in every industry, including mining. So that's a very brief review of Jeff.
All right. The next question is, can you tell me the story of when my dad was born? And can you describe the moment when you saw my dad for the first time?
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we lived in Kearney, Arizona. They didn't have an OBGYN there. And I just didn't feel good about having the baby there. Paula had found one of the doctors there that she liked, and she was going to deliver that way. And I thought, I don't feel good about that. Made her change doctors. We went down, found a people in the ward had gone to a doctor in OBGYN in Scottsdale, Arizona. So we drove down there, and Paula ended up liking him. I liked him too. And that was probably a blessing that we had him. When Jeff came, I never remember which way the face is supposed to be, but he was 180 degrees off. And when the baby's that way, they can't come through the cervix. And so Paula was in labor quite some time. She went into labor early in the morning, and we says, "Oh, my pains are about 5 minutes apart." We were both ignorant, and I thought, man, I better drive faster. So I drove faster in hopes that a cop would pull me over. There were no cops at 2 a.m. So then she said, "Well, the pains have quit." I said, "Well, we're down here now. We'll just go into the hospital." And I looked at her and says, "Yeah, she'll have the baby, but it won't be until tonight." So she went into to labor, gave her a blessing before we left, and told her that everything would be okay. And then she got in there. Of course, the pain is there. And I guess one of the most difficult things for me to do was to see her in pain and know I couldn't do anything to help her. And so all I could do was stand around. And of course, she couldn't have anything to eat. She said, "Well, go get you something to eat." And I said, "No, that'll just be bad for you." No, go and you can eat it there. So I went to a McDonald's, bought a hamburger and fries and a drink, and came back. She wanted to know all about it, so I told her what I had. Probably, I think I had a Big Mac. I still like Big Macs. Anyway, so they kept going, and they had shift change on the nurses, and a B shift nurse, or the afternoon evening shift, came on, and the doctor came up and talked to me, and he says, "The baby's just not coming." He says, "If this baby doesn't come here in the next half hour, we're going to have to take an emergency C-section." And I thought, oh, wow. And so I gave Paul another blessing. And the B-shift nurse came in, and name is Ruth Flynn. I still remember that. She looked at Paula's chart and says, "All right, honey, we're going to make this baby move." And said, "Roll over on your side." And Paula says, "Oh, it hurts, it hurts." She says, "I know it hurts, and it'll hurt the baby, and he'll move." And sure enough, within a half hour, he turned, and then they couldn't wheel her into the delivery room fast enough. He was coming, and he came, out, and didn't have time to put any mirrors up so I could look, and I thought, that's okay, I don't want to look anyway. So the baby came out. "You want to cut the cord?" "No, thank you." And so that was the first time I saw Jeff. Of course, they come out a little bit blue and bloody and pussy all over him, and they clean all that up. And so that was the first time I saw him. And then I started called my parents. And I think I called Paula's parents. And then when she was feeling a little better, she called her parents again and let her know. So that was the first time I saw Jeff. We'd already decided on a name. We both sort of like Jeffrey, but like spelling it with a G. And then I didn't want any juniors or seconds, but I did want one of their names to tie him to one of their ancestors. So in this case, he was Jeffrey Scott Norby. And we did that with each one of our sons. One of their names tied him to an ancestor, but there were no juniors or seconds.
All right. The next question is, can you tell me about what you do or did for a living?
Okay. As a kid growing up on Sunday nights in Salt Lake City, Kennecott always sponsored a good family movie. And then all of the commercials were about what Kennecott did out of their mine here in Salt Lake City. And I would miss part of the movie if I had to go out and do something or whatever. But I wasn't going to miss the commercials because that just fascinated me to look at that. And so I grew up seeing that. Probably the last job my mother had is she worked for Kennecott at their research center. And because of that, during my junior and senior years at school, I was able to get a very coveted job at Kennecott's research center also, which paid for my schooling and books and a little bit of spending money. A lot of kids applied for those. I'm sure part of the reason I got it is because of my mother working there. But it was so convenient because as long as you had an hour to spend, they'd let you come in and work whenever you wanted to. So I could go to class, and if I had an hour, and I could go to my next class or whatever it turned out to be. But I enjoyed mining. I still enjoy it. Still like to see what the progress you make and the things that are challenges and problems that you have to resolve and take care of. My degree was metallurgical engineering, but the Kennecott's philosophy was that once you have a degree, we'll put you in whatever we need you, and you can learn what you have to do, which has been true, and I enjoyed that because I was always having something new to learn, something different to do. And because of that, I went to a variety of properties throughout my career. I worked in Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Nevada, Utah, California. Now we're back in Utah. I spent some time in Labrador City, Canada, at an iron ore mine with Rio Tinto, which had purchased Kennecott. Also did some work on closed properties in gold mines, particularly in Wisconsin, Ladysmith, and Columbia, South Carolina. And then the older copper mine in Ely, Nevada, plus Alaska. I was up in Alaska at a lead zinc mine doing some safety type work there. So I've enjoyed going to various places and learning a lot of different things, having different jobs, because I get bored after a while. And, okay, it's time to learn something different. So that's an industry that I chose, and I've been happy with it.
The next question is, do you have any favorite stories from your work life?
From my work life?
Mm-hmm.
Favorite stories from my work life. Oh, at times it's fun to be a boss. Other times it's a pain in the butt to put up with some of the problems you have to do. Ended up working in union environments and non-union environments. I preferred the non-union. It was easier and simpler. But you had good people in the union environments too. The craft unions, I never really had a problem with the craft unions. Those were people that had been to college to learn a lot of their stuff. Probably the biggest challenge you had were the steel workers, at least in the mining industry. But your IBEW, your mechanics, pipe fitters, boiler makers, didn't have any problem with them. They were good, reasonable people, and I tried to be the same way to them. That's just more probably on the environmental side of it. Favorite stories, I can think of one that I was working with a young man. He was a shift supervisor like I was in the pit. And I was able to talk to him about the gospel. And never converted him, but he learned about what the church entailed. Another time I had another peer, and he was able to talk to him about the church, try to encourage him. It helped him a little bit, but he wasn't willing to change. And you can't force him, but those were fun experiences. And one time when I had the blasting crew, they all spoke Spanish. my very limited Spanish was from high school. And so they were talking one day, and I figured out they were talking to me, or talking about me, I should say. And so I answered them in Spanish. Then they were embarrassed. I never did tell them how little I understood, but after that, they wouldn't talk about me. They'd do it behind my back where I couldn't hear them. That was a funny experience. Had some good friends that we made over the years, particularly in Kearney. I was there 16 years in Arizona till I finally had to move because the company was purchased by another company and they were bringing in their own management. That wasn't the most pleasant thing to do, but I could see the handwriting on the wall. I said, well, I know I can do better. After they demoted me and cut my pay by a third, and I did. I went and found a superintendent job and made almost the exact same money I had before, and it didn't take long, and I was being promoted and back on my way up, which is something I wanted in my career. Interesting story. After Asarco was the company that bought Kennecott, Ray Mines Division in Arizona. And after I left, one of my brother-in-laws, Paula's brother, was working, and they made a comment one time. They said, well, we certainly made him a Scot when they found out Philip and I were related. He said, well, we made a mistake getting rid of Scot. We should have kept him. And that made me feel good. But by then, I was much happier that I'd left. Things were a whole lot better in my life. Because, again, I knew I could work, and I was willing to work. Probably one of the most frustrating things I've had over the years is I work and I expect other people to work, and other people don't always work. And that frustrates me when they're not willing to pull their weight. So what was that question again, Liesl? Yeah, just to make sure I answered it.
Do you have any favorite stories from your work life?
Okay, I guess that's some good ones.
What did you want to be when you were little?
Oh, I don't remember wanting to be a fireman or a policeman or anything like that. I remember I got 10, 11, 12 or whatever, maybe 13. I wanted to be like my dad and work in the post office. And my dad said, no, you don't want to do that. And so I said, what do I do, Dad? And he says, take all the math, science, and like chemistry and physics and math that you can take. It'll prepare you. And so I did that through high school. I took all those classes. And when I graduated from high school, get close to graduating, talked to the high school counselor, and I said, what scholarships do you have? Because I knew my parents didn't have the money. And so they said, well, what do you want to go into? I said, well, I think I'd choose chemical engineering because I liked chemistry. And the counselor says, well, I don't have any scholarships in that, but we have one in mining, in metallurgical engineering. I said, what's metallurgical engineering? So he explained it to me, and I thought, well, that sounds good. That's what Kennecott does. I think I'll go in that. And so I found out that I got in there in those classes, and I enjoyed them. They were fun. They were hard. You had to work hard in them. And that first year, at least for me, is a transition. You go from high school, where it was sort of a breeze for me, you get to college, and everybody else, it was a breeze for them in high school, and you have to work, and there's a new competition and a different level of studying, and I learned how to do that. So that's why I ended up getting into the mining business.
How did you get into piano?
My mother loved to play the piano. As a little girl, her mother started teaching her how to play the piano, and she loved it. She was 9 years old when her birth mother died, and that ended piano lessons. They couldn't afford it after that. So my mother wanted her children to play the piano. So So when I was 8, I had an aunt that played the piano, and she taught me piano lessons. And along with my siblings below me. And she made sure I practiced. And, you know, nobody likes to practice the piano, but it was a lot of work. But I'm once I got to a certain stage where I could hear a piece, and I'd say, I can play that. All I need is the music and practice. And so that's what I did. I was starting doing that when I was 12 years old. Became a deacon in the church, and they needed a pianist for the priesthood meeting where the men go. And so I went to see my bishop, and he first thing he did was call me to be the priesthood organist. And so I got into that, and so I picked one hymn, and I practiced it all week long so I could play it. What was cute one time is I did the very first song the first Sunday I was there, and I didn't follow the conductor. I just got down, and I didn't even look at him. I just looked at the music and played, and when you got to the end, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I started right again. And I went fast, and afterwards, a conductor turned to me and says, were you going to a fire today? And I said, going to a fire? And he says, you played that so fast and you never looked at me. And I thought, oh, am I supposed to do that? And so I learned. Over the years, I had, in our ward, you didn't have a lot of people that played the piano or the organ. I had a brother the church would send around some people to teach organ lessons so you know what to do, at least play the organs that were in the churches. So I was selected and went to that course and learned how to play the organ. And ever since then, I've played the piano or organ everywhere I've ever been, either as a formal calling or because no one was there and nobody else could do it, whatever, I just did it. So that's how I got into it. I still enjoy it. I don't have the time to practice, or I don't take the time or make the time to practice, but I still enjoy the piano.
All right. So this is a very important question. Why the University of Utah instead of the far superior BYU?
Well, they were both started by the church. University of Utah, one is I had a scholarship in it. They called me from BYU. I could have got into BYU. They said, you're eligible to come, and we'd like to have you come. And I said, well, do you have metallurgical engineering? And they said, no. And I said, all right, I'm going to stay with University of Utah. That's one of the reasons, is because they had my major. The second reason probably is I had a scholarship. So that helped pay for my tuition, which is the exorbitant price of $140 a quarter. That was a lot of money back then. One of the jobs I worked during the summer when I was going to college, I made $2 an hour, and people thought, wow, you're making $2 an hour? Then I got to the University of Utah working at the Kennecott's Research Center, and I made $600 a month. And whoa, you make $600 a month? They were surprised. The last one is at economics. My parents couldn't afford to send me down to BYU. By going to the University of Utah, I could stay at home. And that way they could afford to still have me live in the house. So that's how I got into it.
All right, let's see what questions they have at the top. Can you tell me about someone who had a big influence in your life and like lessons that they taught you maybe?
As you go through life, you'll always find someone that can be a positive influence on you, men or women. I had teachers that I really enjoyed in school. I remember an English teacher, a Mr. Bessie, and I liked him. And I think he liked me too. But he made English fun as we'd read books. I remember reading some of Ernest Hemingway's books, having to do a paper on the futility of war. And that was a fun assignment. I remember down in when I was in grade school, there was a Mrs. Stringham, young teacher fresh out of school. Her husband had been in the Navy, and I remember for Halloween she came in her dressed up in her husband's Navy whites. But she was a fun teacher. I liked her. There was a choral teacher I had in 7th and 8th grade, and I liked him. He liked me because I played the piano. I probably played the piano more than I sang, but he made that a fun class. In the work environment, I've had people that have helped me. Remember the first time I went to Nevada, I had a boss, Dick Jensen, and he was, it was my first time as a superintendent. He was a general manager, and so he taught me a lot of things on what to do, how to do it, things you have to watch for. And you always need someone, if you pay attention to those kind of people, they'll help you. I also had a guy, his name was Rusty, I forget his last name now, when I was working in Arizona. He was an older fellow, he was cantankerous. You wouldn't go up and say, I want to be his friend. But he had a wealth of knowledge because of experience and age. And so I would talk to Rusty frequently. And I gained a lot of information. And because of that, it helped me really excel in that particular job, which then allowed me to take the next job. So I've learned that over the years. You know, talk to the people that have been there a while. There's great wisdom in older people if you'll listen to them. And it'll be a big help to you. So it can either be peers or superiors or someone like that, you know, an older person. You can also learn from younger people. Right now, serving in the temple, there's a young man that I guess you'd call him my supervisor, if you want to put that in quotes. And he knows how the temple works. So what do I do here? And, oh, you boom, 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 and he tells me. And, okay, thank you. So someone can always be a help to you if you look at it and talk to people. And you'll find out something, and you think, oh, okay, tell me about boom, boom, boom. So there's that.
All right. Can you describe one of your happiest memories?
Happiest memories. Marrying my wife. As we knelt across the altar in the Mesa, Arizona temple, I was extremely happy. Had tears in my eyes, and I was very grateful for her. I loved her greatly, and I love her even more now after 49 years of marriage, 6 kids. She's truly been a great companion and helpmeet for me, as the scriptures talk about. So that's probably one of the happiest. Another happiest moment is with the birth of our children. I told you about your dad, Jeff. Eric, we had a little more time. They induced labor because we live so far away from the Scottsdale Hospital. And the doctor says, oh, you want me to put up the mirrors? I said, no, thank you. You just about lost me on my first one. I don't need to see. I'll just see the end result. The last four were all C-section because Clinton and Darren were both breech. When you have a breech baby, they won't deliver it vaginally. You end up having to do a C-section. So there, they said, you can come in, but if you faint on us, you're the last person we're going to come to help. I said, nope, you can just tell me what it is. So, and then just doing family things together. I just enjoy being with family. Family vacations, family hikes, family reunions. It's just fun to get to with family and talk.
All right. What are you proudest of?
Probably my family, grandchildren. It's very comforting to see my grandchildren being raised in the gospel. to know that my children, my sons and daughter-in-laws, are teaching them correctly. I've talked to so many people who have had so many problems with their children and grandchildren, and I've been greatly blessed to see the blessings of the gospel, how it helps families, how it helps children, how it helps parents to try to do what's right. And that's what brings lasting happiness. So that's that one.
All right. If this were to be our very last conversation, is there anything you'd want to say to me?
To you? Mm-hmm. I love you. Proud of you. Always hold on to the iron rod. Don't take vacations from church service. I've seen the tragic results of that in so many people, and it causes so many problems with their kids and grandkids when they don't have a moral compass, and the church provides that moral compass. Follow the prophet. Same thing, what you learned in primary, the little kids. You'll never go wrong if you follow a prophet, and we have a living prophet. And I'd probably then last, the gospel of Jesus Christ is true. I know it. I don't think it's true, hope it's true, believe it's true, wish it was true. I know it's true.
Thank you, Grandpa.
You're welcome.
That's it. So I'm going to end the recording now. Bye.